Jeff.
Hello, Soraya. How you doing?
Doing all right. How about you?
I'm doing well. Hey, Joy. Hey, Howie. Oh, no, not today. I miss those guys.
Hey, Tom.
I
Well,
know. I
not
miss
today either.
I miss all those guys.
I know.
It's back to you and I and a guest.
Sacrifices.
So, did you have fun with that compilation series so far?
Yes, it's always great to go back to albums that mean something to you, but it's just been fun revisiting all those tracks.
Yeah.
So many different bands and sounds. Love it.
Yes. And speaking of revisiting, we wanted to revisit something that we started about a month ago when we were talking to Matt Peucci about David Roback. And we're always curious about David Roback and who he was and his artistry. And I'm always looking for more information about him. And I thought a good idea would be to contact some people that have worked with him. And when I was doing a little bit of research, I noticed that Aaron Scheer, one of the guys who used to play drums in the band that I play in, 17 Pygmies, we didn't play together in the same band, but he also spent some time with Kendra Smith and David Roback doing some songs for Opal and Mazzy Star. So I thought we'd give him a call and see if he can give us a little bit more information.
Love it.
All right, let's give him a call.
Hi, this is Soraya.
And this is Jeff.
Our podcast is called Paisley Stage Raspberry and Rhyme,
a podcast where the two of us play music that we like and share anecdotes and background about the tunes.
We hope you'll join our conversation. And without further ado, agrubiar.
Let's get groovy. All right, let's add Aaron to the call.
Beautiful.
Good morning, Aaron. It's Jeff and Soraya from Paisley Stage Raspberry and Rhyme. How are you this morning?
Hey, morning. How are you?
We're doing great. Thank you so much for taking our call.
Yeah, no problem.
We had a few questions that we wanted to ask you, but before we get into that, I wrote up a little introduction and I'm going to try to read it and sound natural as I read it, as if I'm ad-libbing
Okay.
this. All right. So today on Paisley Stage Raspberry and Rhyme, Soraya and I are chatting with Aaron Scheer, and we wanted to reach out to Aaron because he's worked with Kendra Smith and David Roback, among others. He worked with them on some sessions playing percussion and drums, and we wanted to see if we could learn a little bit more about those two based on Aaron's experience with them. And additionally, we wanted to find out more about his music career, including other projects, writing and recording with Psycom, Shiva Burlesque, Savage Republic, 17 Pygmies, and of course, as previously mentioned, Opal and Mazzy Star. And Aaron, we wanted to thank you so much for taking our call. But first things first, we wanted to ask how you're holding up. Are you safe and healthy during this time of the stay home coronavirus situation?
You know, I live in Northern California, kind of out in the country,
Okay.
and it's beautiful. It's kind of non-existent around here
Wow.
to a degree. I mean, if you go in a supermarket or place like that, people, half the people are wearing masks and gloves. So it's kind of business as usual,
So you're in a little
you
safe
know?
bubble, it sounds like.
Yeah. It seems that way. I mean, it would be a different situation if I were, still living in Hollywood or, you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's, I mean, I'm sitting right now out in my garden, and spring doesn't know COVID virus this year.
Thankfully.
Just, yes, unfolding before us. Yeah. So, yeah, I'm well. I hope you guys are too.
Thank you so much, Aaron. I wanted to know if you could share with our listeners a little bit about how you originally got into music and eventually into drums and percussion.
Oh, okay. That's an easy one. My parents were in the restaurant business for a while. They had a German restaurant in South Bay, right in LA, and then one out in Orange County. And a friend of my dad's was an accordion player, a German one man band, and gave us this accordion and also a snare drum. So I saw the opportunity there, and I chucked the accordion and put the snare drum in the accordion case, and I joined the school band for summer school in Orange County way back in the day, and just started playing drums then.
Wow.
And that was probably maybe 11 years old or so, something like that. And I had no idea, and I didn't know anything about anything, right? Just a, music fan. And that kind of started it. So a gift from a friend kind of created the whole thing.
Perfect.
Nice. So what kind of music were you listening to at that age? Do you recall?
Radio. Pop radio.
Right.
There wasn't a big underground movement that I was aware of at 10 years old. The Beatles. Grew up with the Beatles. And Led Zeppelin just kind of came out, which kind of shocked my world a little bit. I remember I heard the Immigrant Song and thought, what is this?
Yes.
I like it. So just pop music, really.
Right. Well, you mentioned the underground scene that eventually came up as part of LA. And the first time that I came across your name, Aaron, was when I was reading through the liner notes on the LA Mantra 2 double cassette release that came out in 84.
What I see through, yeah, I could.
And that came out on Transport Tapes label. And I originally bought it because there was a 17 Pygmies track on it. That was my first exposure to the band Psycom, which you were a part of. And it's funny, if you read anything now about Psycom, you'll always hear something like, they're noted for being the first band of the acclaimed vocalist Perry Farrell, who went on to great fame with Jane's Addiction, Pyro for Pornos, and started the Lollapalooza Festival. That's what usually goes along with anything Psycom related.
Exactly.
So was that your first band, and can you tell us how that band got started?
No, that was not my first band. I've been, for years, a professional musician, right? Doing sessions, things like that. I mean, occasionally I'll still hear myself on the radio on a jingle that survived time or something. Or I've always been in a lot of different scenes, and not any one in particular, primarily because for me, music isn't confined by genres, or it's to me, I think, or there's all types of music: fast, slow, loud, soft, bad, good, and that permeates through all styles of music. So I listen to all styles of music. I listen to jazz, I listen to classical, I listen to rock, everything. So when I joined Psycom, I was just kind of looking for something different. I was a little burned out on the big music scene.
Okay.
And looking for something more to get into. So prior to that point, I played with tons of different people.
Wow.
No particular band of any acclaim, but, a few big names along the way. But, gigs with, like, Etta James, Bonnie Bramlett, even people like... James Galway, classical flautist.
Wow.
So pretty diverse, really.
Yeah, it sounds like it. So then how did Psycom come about?
Ad in the LA Weekly.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
We've heard that.
Ad in the LA Weekly. And I met those guys, and Perry's like, oh, cool, you look like me.
Oh.
You have a little braid in your hair or something, I don't know. I just, it was cool. We clicked, and there was an intensity there. So, we made a go of it.
Soraya, we've heard that the answering an ad quite a few times, haven't we? That was
I'm
pretty
telling you,
funny.
I am telling you, this just brought a smile to my face, knowing that it was an LA Weekly ad that and I just wanted to ask a couple of follow-up questions about SICOM, because what we know is that SICOM had one official release, which was a self-titled EP in 85 on Mohini Records. And then
Nice.
one unofficial release, which was actually a demo recorded the year before, a cassette-only release titled Work Take One. And we were curious, what was the dynamic like in SICOM? And, if you have any stories you'd like to share with us about your time in the band, we'd love to hear it because
Well,
this is
the
really
lineup
interesting.
changed over the years, first ish. Originally, Mariska Lacios was our keyboard player, and her husband Rich was a bass player. And he and Perry kind of butted heads quite a bit, and eventually he got frustrated with the band and kind of threw a little temper tantrum and left the band. So we needed a new bass player. So we found, you eventually found Kelly, bass player, and then it was, difficult for Mariska to stay in the band without Rich. So then it was the lineup that was on the SICOM Mohini release. The work tape, I've seen 100 different work tapes. So when it was released, I mean, we recorded a lot of different stuff, and there's, fans of ours recorded live shows and things. So there was a lot of stuff floating around. Dynamic of the band, we grew when we had Kelly in the band to a little different direction, and there was a lot of really good material that never got released that I won't say your classic psychedelic category, but more drawing you away from your world and into it, another dimension,
Oh, wow.
trying to, there was a lot of good stuff that I could be proud of even today. Some little flavors of that, made it to the, EP, where we stretch out some tunes and create a lot of space without being accused of being jazz or
Yeah,
I'm
right.
sorry if that, I don't know if that answered your question. I
Absolutely.
kind of cut you off, sorry.
No, absolutely.
So then, Aaron, what happened for the band to dissolve? Was it just time, the people moving on, or?
At the root of it, I really, really kind of think Perry really wanted to have that big rock star status and really be worshipped. And a little battle of wills, you know, musically, where if you didn't jump on board and be excited about his idea, immediately you could see the fire go out of his eyes, you know.
Right.
Like, no, that's actually kind of a not a good idea, Perry. but just, you know, that sounds a bit harsh, but, you know, I think there's a lot of truth to it, though, really. And he's got his, you know, fame and his followers, and, you know, he was really after that for a variety of reasons, you know. Coming from a broken home, his mom died when he was really little, he found her dead. You know, we have a song about that, actually.
Wow.
Back in the day, that was super intense.
Was that a song that got released?
I've heard it on, you know, just bootleg kind of things. Silhouette was the name of that song. Yeah, it was an intense song. I mean, one where, you know, I found myself more than a few times while we were playing, just, you know, tears would be coming out, you know.
Wow.
It was intense. Yeah.
Shortly after, well, it might have been years after Psycom, well, probably a couple of years, I went to see 17 Pygmies play, and you were playing on drums. It was at the Lhasa Club. And
right, I remember that gig.
Yeah, also on the bill were Firehose and Jane's Addiction, I believe.
Right.
Does that sound right? So here you are playing, sitting in drums for another band, 17 Pygmies, and Perry from your previous band is playing in a different band. That had to have been weird or awkward, I would imagine.
Well, you know, James was becoming huge at that time. They were all the talk in LA, and like, I don't know if they were signed yet or not. I don't think they were, but the bidding war was on, right? They were hot stuff, you know, about to launch to, you know, big time. And I was just kind of setting things out a little bit. You know, I didn't have a band I was in or anything. And I think I got a call from Greg Grunke, who played bass in 17 Pygmies at that time, saying, hey, you want to do this gig with 17 Pygmies? And I kind of knew the people in 17 Pygmies, but I really didn't, you know, we weren't buddies or anything and hung out.
Right.
So I said, okay, I'll do it. Why not? Playing the Lhasa. Had maybe an hour of rehearsal or something. So my typical way of faking my way through a whole gig, you know, just really trying to listen and see what's going on. And after our rehearsal, the one rehearsal, I asked Greg, so, you know, he said, oh, your name is Jane's Addiction. And I thought he was joking, right? And I laughed, like, yes, you're me. Okay. And he goes, no, we're playing with Jane's Addiction. And I was like, oh, my God. I haven't played anywhere in 6 months, and here I'm going to play, like, you know, a gig with Perry, and, you know, anyhow. So I thought, okay, whatever comes our way. And got to the gig, and I remember at that particular show, I always tried to tune my drums to the room. You know, I was kind of a fanatic for tone, and so I wanted a kind of a low fat sound, because it was kind of a box. The Lhasa, if you remember.
Yes, yeah.
And, it could just be, you know, cacophony. And I wasn't going for cacophony. I wanted fat, warm tones, right? Kind of big bottom underneath whatever the Pygmies were doing. And at one point in the gig, I knew Perry was going to do that. I turned to my side, and he's there pointing at me laughing like, oh, my God, look at you. Ah, you guys.
Oh, my gosh.
And I was like, don't be an ass. You know, just played the rest of my gig, and I'm like, move along.
Yeah.
But so that was a little bit odd, but karma, right?
Yeah.
Back, of course you're gonna play a gig with Perry. But that's actually that leads us to Opal,
yeah.
Because apparently Dave was in the audience, and I don't know if he was with Suki or Kendra, but apparently he was there. And I don't know, I think I got a call from Dave you know, I don't know how many months after that gig, but basically they said they just liked the sound of the drums.
Wow.
And maybe the playing too. So that was kind of a whole, I was trying to remember this the other day, because, you know, I never think about these things, but he was at that gig, and I don't know, you know, Suki, so you, maybe you could verify with her. I don't know if it was Suki or if it was Kendra, but I know Dave was there for sure. And that's what opened up the Opal Mazzy Star stuff for me. Meant to intrude on, by the way, because I know Keith was their drummer, and I was never after anybody's gig, you know. So
yes, I was interested about that, because you're noted as playing on the Happy Nightmare album, and other than seeing a credit of your name on the album, and I know Keith plays on the album as well, I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is that you did on Happy Nightmare Baby. Do you recall what songs or song that you played on?
You know, I have to actually listen and
look
at it. But the thing is, with Dave, and whether it was Opal or Mazzy, we recorded so much stuff that never made it to a release. I was thinking about this today. We did this some studio in Santa Monica where we recorded most of that early Opal stuff. We did a Mark Bolan tune rock section. I thought we did a great version of that, and Kendra, it was one of Kendra's tunes, her arrangement on it, but that never made it to, as far as I know, never made it to a release, but we were famous in my book for recording tons of stuff and releasing just a fraction of it.
Oh, wow.
That blew my mind.
So I can't remember, honestly, which tunes I played on. I know it wasn't Happy Nightmare Baby. That's got Keith all over it.
So it sounds like both of you were working on sessions, you and Keith.
Yeah, and I don't know if they just wanted to. I don't really know the motivation there. Were they unhappy with them, or they just want a different flavor or something? Because I always thought that he was a better fit, you know, sonically for the band.
Mm-hmm.
But whatever, you just go forward, right? So.
Yeah, especially if they want you, right?
Right.
Yeah. And I won't say butt heads, but we'd be in the studio sometimes and, okay, take five, take six, take seven. And David might make a comment like, the drums sound like they're rushing in this part. And I'd be, okay, you know, if anybody ever makes some mention of my playing, I'm the first one to, you know, go within and internalize this and think, what am I doing? Am I playing this? And you don't want to think, especially as a drummer, you don't want to think too much about tempo. You want to be in the moment. You don't want to put your energy into analyzing it as you're going along. You want to express it as you go along.
Right.
And there's a, you know, any player will tell you that and experience that, you know, they listen to something that they did when they were just thinking about all these different styles or how I'm going to do this. And it's, gosh, I can't believe I was so stupid back then. I was so fixated on these things rather than just being at the edge of creativity and floating along through time and space, connecting all that music together. Anyhow, we'd have these little stressy moments, and they'd listen to playback, and the engineer would look at me and kind of raise eyebrows like, it's spot on. It's not rushing. Being a bit frustrated. I can't even remember the studio, but we were recording, right? And one of these tunes, it was like take 7 or 8. And I was always like the 1 or 2 takes. That's it. You know, we got it. You know, we nailed it, or let's try something. But I, out of frustration, I just kept playing and, you know, kind of singing the song to myself. And I played the whole tune. And I motioned the engineer just keep rolling, right? So I'm just playing by myself, and everybody stopped and finished. They listened back, and I'm not patting myself on the back here because this was just out of frustration. Not that I was such a talented metronome of a player, but, you know, they played back, and apparently they scrapped the song, and David wrote a new song to the new drum track, because after listening to it over and over again, he liked the drum track. Anyhow.
Oh, wow. So he wrote to that drum track?
Yeah. And I don't know what the song is, but I think Kendra told me that afterwards. Yeah.
Wow. Can you tell us a little bit about the dynamic of that band, or with Kendra and David?
Things were... dynamic is probably the last word that I would use.
Okay.
Things were very dry. Almost, I had to slow down, like, everything to get through rehearsals and things. I remember Will, the bass player at the time, and I find myself, like, wanting to finish people's sentences, or, you know, because there was so much internal thought, and he would say something like, perhaps... we can try slowing it down a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm a drummer, and I'm not your typical, like, boom, 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 gotta go, drummer, but I am a drummer, and we're physical, and, you know, you want to play what's right for the tune, but they were a little bit very cerebral.
Okay.
You know, yeah. Anyhow. So dynamic between Kendra and David. I don't really have any shockers or zingers or anything. They all seemed to work pretty well together. Dave kind of had an idea in his mind, but I could see how it could be influenced. And if you planted a seed, it could get him to start thinking a different way. I remember we rehearsed at his place where he lived, his parents' house. He had this huge garage, and he had an apartment above that. and schlepping gear up the stairs. I gave him an album to listen to, and he'd never heard of these guys. And I gave him Wire's 154 album.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I'm sure you guys are familiar with it, but to me, that's one of the epic, you know, just a great, great, great album for so many different reasons. And I never did catch up with him to find out, you know, what he thought, but I know he would listen to it. I knew he would listen to it.
Right now I'm trying to wrap my head around that of those sessions and some of the feedback, and I really like that story of your drums setting the tone for a brand new song. I really like that. Aaron, I wanted to ask one other thing. In addition to the credit with Opal, you're credited playing on Mazzy Star's third full-length album, Among the Swan, that was released in 1996 on Capitol.
Right.
Now, and you're credited as playing drums on a couple of songs, Still Cold. And Take Everything, which also includes William Reed on guitar, William Reed from Jesus and Mary Jane.
Right, yep.
Are really curious about the recording sessions for that album and how that may have gone, because now that I heard the Opal story, now I want to hear the Mazzy Star story.
Right. So I thought after like the Opal stuff, I kind of thought I'd be, you know, I'd never get a call back from them because, you know, they had a drummer and they had their own sound and everything. And I was with a good friend of mine, Walter Earle, and we were going to see Susie and the Banshees at the Wiltern. And going backstage, right, we had passes, and of course, and opened the door, and I bump into David and his girlfriend at the time. I don't know her name, but he's like, Aaron, what are you doing here? Like, David, what are you doing here? And he said, you know, I think I must have given him my number. He said, we're going to record. I've been trying to get a hold of you. Like, okay. Here's my number, and I went and sat on the side of the stage and watched the whole show. Then I heard, I don't know, a couple weeks later or so, I got a call, and we recorded at this studio up in Berkeley. So we flew up for the weekend. I flew up with Jill Emery, and that session, I kind of felt almost a little more out of place. I don't know. It was a bit odd, the whole recording, because I thought we were all just on friendly terms, and we were, but they wanted to record more. You know, we did a bunch of recording and later in the day, and I was going to come back to LA, and they wanted me to stay and record, but David didn't say, hey, could you hang out another day?
Mm-hmm.
They went in the room next door and made a phone call, and then I got a call from management. I think they were on Lookout Management at the time, but anyhow, I got a call from their manager kind of saying, okay, we can pay you, you know, $500 if you, and I was like, this is so weird. Why didn't David just ask me if I could stay another day? I never really cared about the money or anything, but just let's not stop being friends and relating. It was a bit odd. Because they had this huge success, as an Azzy star, I guess everything had to be, you know, business-like. And it was, that recording was, I guess the word I have to come up with is compartmentalized, because you had Hope and, what's the guy's name, Will? From Jesus and Mary Chain.
Oh, yeah.
They were in their little love cocoon everywhere, right? They just kept to themselves. They're barely spoken amongst the players.
Oh, okay.
It was kind of, okay, we're going to do this song. So it was a bit odd. And, you know, I tried some different things. And I think Will, the bass player for Opal, he was there. I don't know if he was an active member of Mazzy at the time or just buddies with David, but he was there and kind of, I don't know if he was co-producing, but he had input. And I remember at one point him asking if I could play something less glorious on the drums or something to that effect, like, you know, don't give it all you got, just kind of lay back more. Or, okay, whatever, I'll try, you know. But it was a bit, like, compartmentalized, like I say, a bit odd. And, you know, for somebody that you have history with, you know, you think, you know, getting a phone call from management one day that we're sitting right in the next room on the phone with the guy anyways, okay, I'll stay another day.
Yeah, that sounds a little odd, yeah. It sounds
a little weird, yeah.
It sounds a little impersonal.
A little bit. You know, I mean, I understand they're, you know, a big name now and all that, but, you know, that's not where I'm coming from with it, mm-hmm. You know. Anyhow.
You know, Aaron, Jeff and I have had this conversation. So, you know, what you're sharing with us right now is really kind of helping us, I don't want to use the word understand, but definitely kind of see things a little differently with regards to Kendra Smith and David Roback, who for Jeff and I, you know, admittedly, they're mysteries to us. But yeah. The focus of our podcast, The Pace in the Underground, yeah. They play these huge primary roles. And right.
They're both fairly guarded, you know.
And yeah. That's what we were curious about. What could, I mean, you've worked with them. And what could you tell our listeners that would help them perhaps understand those two artists a little better?
I don't know, they're similar, but they're very different. Kendra opened her heart quite a bit more to me than, you know, David. David, I could see everything you said. It just, I could see the wheels turning, right? You just go in and you'd be thinking and thinking and thinking. And I don't know how he was thinking about things, but he was internalizing all this stuff. I think he led a very, I'm speculating, but it appears to me that he led a very sheltered life. And like I said, when I gave him the, you know, Wire album, he'd never heard of him, one, which is no big deal, right? But that's why I hope is that it would broaden his horizons, or maybe he could trip out a little more in this direction, because, you know, they obviously had potential, you know, they were into what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And coming up with some very nice things. Some of it, you know, I just was like, it's too dry for me. You know, I need a little more heart in there or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was more cerebral like that. I don't think Kendra was. Kendra was a little more face value.
Okay.
She just, you know, and like I said, opened her heart to me. We had we had some nice times together. Spent a little time meditating together, you know, and non-musical relationship, I should say.
Okay.
So someone you could get closer to than David, probably.
Right.
So would you say that your relationship with Kendra was more on a personal level than David? That's what it sounds like.
Yeah, for sure. I think so.
Yeah.
So when she disappeared, I was surprised, but I wasn't surprised. Because I did the same thing.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Do you think it was for the same reasons? Would you speculate that it was she was looking for something with a little bit more heart?
That I don't know. I think she just kind of wanted to get out of town, but realized there is a world beyond the music business. That's where I think it was, you know, more coming from. Just because you leave the machine doesn't mean you stop. You stop being a musician, or stop having feelings or whatever. It's just you've kind of stepped outside a bubble and think, oh, now you can look back at it and give yourself some perspective. Do you want to pursue that, or do you want to just do what you do on your own?
Right, right.
Chart your little course in the world, come what may.
That's kind of heavy. So thank you for that. I appreciate that. So did your relationship with Kendra remain, or with the...
No, I lost full contact with her. You know, I don't know where she is or what she's doing these days. I just know we had a moment in time.
Perfect, perfect, yeah. Well, thank you for
which
that.
Which I completely respect, you know.
Yeah, yeah, by all means, yeah. Yeah, I really appreciate all that understanding. It's helping me to actually, like Soraya said, I don't know if it's understand, but maybe get to know them a little better, or another mm-hmm. piece of the puzzle that we don't know about. Yeah.
Yeah.
So Aaron,
honestly, I mean, I'm here speaking about this stuff, but we didn't spend all that much time together. You know, when you record something, it's boom, it's there for all time.
Right. Okay?
So, but your lives go in different directions. The recording may capture that moment in time.
Yeah, that's the beautiful thing I think about recordings or music. It does capture a moment in time.
Mm-hmm.
And for those of us as listeners, that we can revisit those. And it may mean something different to us than the artists, but there's that.
It could be a happy nightmare, baby.
Yeah.
<You know>.
Yeah.
Eternally.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Hey, Aaron, I wanted to switch gears a little bit and talk about a couple more sessions that you worked on, non-Opal, non-Mazzy Star. You and I have a couple loose connections, one of which is the label Nate Starkman & Son. My band White Glove Test had a couple releases on the label. You played on a release from that label, and it was Shiva Burlesque's debut album. You played on a song. Three members of Shiva Burlesque eventually went on to form or become Grant Lee Buffalo. But I understand you played tabla on the song Work the Rat.
Pharaoh's face fell from the skylight under the bed where Jesus lied. The light in the sky was non-existent, being dark out being night. Naked and sad, the neighbors sat and asked him, did you work the rat?
How did that come about? And can you tell us about that session?
Sure. Well, connection with Nate Starkman and Son. Have you guys seen the Desolation Center movie?
Yeah, I have. Yes. Yeah.
Just
yes.
I loved it. It was really nice. Well,
so good.
Stuart was an old friend of mine. I worked side by side with his brother, Ken Sweezy. So Stuart Sweezy connected with so many people in our little circle, right, with Bruce Leisher, right? He put on the Desolation Center shows and Savage Republic was the, you know, and the Minutemen were one of the first bands to play any of the DC shows. I became friends with all those guys through a variety of people. I think Mariska introduced me to Stuart. But, and then I met Jeff through Bruce Leisher, I think. I think that's how I met Jeff from Shiva Burlesque.
Okay.
And then we ended up working together. There was this little repro company in Santa Monica called City Repro. We did photostat kind of stuff. This was our day gig. And Perry and I worked there for several years. A lot of musicians, Kurt Schellenbach, right, from Nip Drivers, and Dave Childs from Lawndale. We all worked there together. It was party atmosphere.
Oh, wow.
Jimmy Bratt. I don't know if you know Jimmy Bratt. He was kind of different kind of music, but a lot of musicians worked there for a while just because it was a cool hang day gig. Anyhow, so Jeff asked me to play. I had only just received this tablas from Stuart, who had gone to India, and he brought that back for me, this tablas, and I don't know how to play those things. It's like I've done, like, you know, percussion gigs or sessions where I'm playing congas, and I am not, there are real conga players, there are real tabla players. I'm not one of those. I fake it through there, so I can add that little flavor, like the kind of the Tijuana Brass version mariachi.
Yeah, right.
Kind of, here's the, you know, tabla for white people.
Yeah, exactly.
I admittedly fake my way through that and just play what I feel with it. Kind of the same thing I do on drums, honestly. I know how to think about it, but. So anyhow, I added that flavor on that because I was, you know, knew Jeff. And I just bumped into him. He lives now up in Northern California also.
Oh, wow. I didn't
know
that.
Nevada City. And he runs a theater up in Nevada City, which is a really cool place. I saw him. He and Bruce and I got together because they had a Desolation Center movie premiere up in Nevada City that was hosted by Jeff.
Oh.
So it was awesome to see those two guys I hadn't seen in years.
That is super
But that's
cool.
How the Shiva Burlesque connection came along.
Huh, interesting. Yeah, and you mentioned Bruce of Savage Republic. You're also included on a live version of the Savage Republic song Spice Fields on the 1990.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there's a 1990 various artist compilation, Sacred War, and it's got a live version of Spice Fields, and you're noted as playing on it. According to the liner notes, it says that it was the final performance of Savage Republic, I think, for that time, as of 1990. Of course, they've gone on to play a different version of the band, and even with some of the
right.
originals. Yeah. But I guess that was recorded at the Wash in Claremont, California, February 25th, 1989. Do you remember that show or playing with Savage Republic?
Do. I remember that very vividly because they had no lights on this little amphitheater. So I pulled my car behind the band and I left my lights on. And so we were backlit, which was kind of a cool effect. But also I had my daughter, who was just a baby at the time, with me. Typical musician gig, right?
Yeah.
Bring my kid.
Yeah, right.
So I strapped her in her car seat, like sitting right behind her on the ground with headphones on, and played the gig. And it was a lot of fun. I love those guys in Savage Republic. Nice friends, all of them. You know, from Greg, I'm really good friends with Tom Furman in the new Savage Republic, right? Also.
Right, yeah.
But my daughter was probably, I don't know, year and a half, 2 years old. And eventually, maybe, I don't know, 2 years ago, Savage Republic was playing in San Francisco, and she and I went down for the gig, and it was like, that's the first time she's seen everybody since she was strapped into a car seat to Savage Republic at the Wash.
Yeah, wow.
In front of the car with the headlights, you know, some Cruella de Vil backlit, you know. Anyhow, yeah.
Wow.
That was fun.
I love that
I
image.
I did tour with Savage Republic or go to Europe or any of those things. But, you know, I'm sure I could have if I pursued that, but things were not to be.
Very cool. I love the imagery of that with your daughter in the car. So.
Yeah, it was fun. I definitely remember that.
Very cool. Are there any projects right now that you're currently involved with?
No, not right now.
Are there any?
No, I've done things over the years, you know, but, and again, I so many different styles of music. Before I left LA, and my youngest was born, and he's like, got kids, and I'm a grandfather, just like you, Jeffrey. Grandchildren, I got some of my own, they're awesome.
Yes.
But my youngest was born, and I thought, you know what, it's time to get out of Hollywood. Mm-hmm. At LA, and that was early 96. So just before I left, sometime maybe a year or something, that was the last Mazzy thing I did. I did a Stevie Wonder album, which is kind of course total different direction, but I spent a lot of time with Stevie in long nights.
Wow.
Name that tune. Yeah, while everybody would get their shit together in studio, it's name that tune all night.
Okay, I have to ask.
Oh my god!
Did you stump him on any tune?
No, he would try really, really, really hard to stump me, because he would play something and it'd be really, really jazzy. He's like, okay, what's this? Tell me what this is. Play it in like this jazzy thing, and then it would like almost be a classical, you know, piano. I'm like, Eleanor Rigby. Okay. Tell me what this is. Play some other song.
Wow.
I absolutely love that guy. He's music personified.
That is
awesome.
That's an amazing story.
Yes.
I can see Stevie Wonder. He seems to be that sort of cheeky sort of fellow where he wants try and, you know, get you. And that's excellent. Are you currently, do you currently play music, play drums or?
I play drums and guitars and keyboards and all that. Mm-hmm. You know, I practically am a little music store unto myself, but like everybody is if you're in it long enough, right? But I'm not actively gigging or anything like that. Uh-huh. And, you know, I think when David passed recently, I just posted a little thing on Facebook about the interaction before. I think they were going to Australia, and through Suki, we reconnected, and kind of sussing out my situation, like, wow, are you playing, right? And I could tell, because Keith had passed, and I thought, my feeling was that, you know, it's like, hey, you want to go to Australia with us, be in the band, kind of thing, which I declined for a variety of reasons, but, you know, that was the last interaction I had with David. But so no musical projects currently that I'm embarked on.
All right. So I'm guessing there's nothing that you would want to promote.
No, not really.
Can I ask you one last question then, Aaron? Sure. And it's looking back on the stuff that you've recorded on and projects that you've been involved with, whether they've been recorded or not, do you have one thing that you look back at with the most fondness?
With the most fondness? You know, there probably some SciComm stuff, because there was so much. I'll back up just a second. My playing since I started playing early on, I always wanted to just give 100%, give everything that I was, all my substance, give it to the music.
Okay.
And some people would say, come up to me after a gig and say, wow, it looks like you were really into it. And I look at them like, why wouldn't I be?
Yeah.
I don't understand why. I play with a million people that are, you know, so much ego and, you know, it's a bummer, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But if you get somebody that really is it giving from their their very being, it touches you. It'll touch some people. It'll touch their hearts. So I think with back in the day with Psycom, we had quite a few of those. It was kind of a special band where, you know, people that would come up after the gig sobbing and saying, I don't know what you did, or you hit me, or, you know, just connected.
Right.
You know, and those were, you can't deny the reality of that kind of experience. And I was, that once you get a taste of that, I was always looking for that taste, playing music, to be, I'll back up a little further. You look at religion, right? And it's, most religions, whatever, you can pick the religion, it doesn't matter. They're all kind of the same way. It's the optimal situation for the devotee would be to dovetail their will to the will of the Supreme, or to something bigger than themselves. Music is the same thing, and you get that same taste, that spirituality, by dovetailing your own will to the will of the tune, so to speak. The tune will take on a kind of a power of its own if you become part of it.
I like that.
So when these separate wheels are dovetailed, it becomes something much stronger than just the guitar part, the drum part, the vocal, the lyrics, whatever, lyrical content. It becomes something different, and it becomes something different to everybody. We had a little, kind of a little battle in Psycom where Jerry wanted to put our pictures in like little bios and stuff. I didn't want to put anything. I said, let the music speak for itself. And the lyrics, at least put the lyrics. Well, I don't want to even do that, because you hear one lyric and it means something to you. I hear a lyric, it means something to me. I mean, you know, I thought, you know, Creedence said there's a bathroom on the right, or Jimi Hendrix, excuse me while I kiss this guy, or, you know.
Yeah.
And you have your own point of reference. You have your own circumstances, and those human circumstances will connect with the human circumstances and the gift of the music.
Wow.
If it's in its purest sense. And it's not complicated, it's just honesty. That's all. Anyhow, if any of that made sense.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It did.
Yeah. I love that.
I have one last question, because I really enjoyed hearing that you're such a music fan with such a wide variety of interests. Is there something you're listening to right now that you're really enjoying?
I'm old school. I still make playlists and listen to them over and over. So there's, you know, modern stuff I'm listening to. There's old stuff I listen to. Of the older stuff, I kind of delved back into the Moody Blues.
Oh, wow.
So good.
Yeah, there's so much great stuff from them. Let's see, what new am I listening to?
And while you're at it, since you're looking, I want to know one song from the Moody Blues that's really resonating with you right now.
Oh, okay. Let's see. The Actor by the Moody Blues.
Okay.
Back in the day when people kind of could take time and have more thematic music.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I like all sorts of things, right? From pop stuff.
Sure.
To classical, to jazz, you know, I went probably at least a year straight of listening to Miles Davis.
Oh, wow.
Blue, every single day. Every single day I listened to that record, start to finish, probably multiple times. And I just heard different stuff every time I listened to it. But then I knew from Miles, and then I like, you know, there's a song, As If by Magic. I love that. First Aid Kit, they have a song, Amy Lou. It's just, you know, really high, sweet harmony, but it really kind of touches a spot, a soft spot in your heart. And I don't know, I mean, a million other things, but I just can't deliver anything right now.
No, this was perfect. This is perfect.
Yeah.
Yes, Aaron, thank you so much. I really enjoyed the conversation. I especially like your take on on music and what it means and what it can be to the listener. I really yeah. like that. And of course, we loved hearing about your experiences with your different projects and giving us a little bit more insight into Kendra and David. I really appreciate the whole conversation.
Oh, my pleasure. I'm a nobody, but I was there a little bit, you know? So there's my perspective.
We really appreciate your perspective. Sure. You have a very unique perspective that a lot of people don't have. So we really right. appreciate that.
Oh, cool. Hope it's a good one. Hope it has a positive influence somewhere.
Yes, we hope so too.
I guarantee that it will.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Aaron, for your time today. And you take yeah. care.
All right, you guys too.
Bye. All right, stay healthy. All right. Bye. Bye-bye.
That is one cool dude.
He is. And I'll just throw this in. Yeah, I jammed with Stevie Wonder. And we did a little name that tune thing together. No big deal.
Can you imagine that? Just saying, yeah, and he tried to stump me, but he couldn't. And I tried to stump him, but I couldn't.
Yeah.
And then I'm thinking, I want to hear Stevie Wonder play me Eleanor Rigby in a classical style.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah, that's cool.
But, you know, look, what I like about Aaron is what I've liked about a lot of the musicians that we've talked to. They're real music fans. And, you know, I like what he said at the beginning. He goes, you know, it can't just be one little box you put yourself into. But, you know, music is about a lot of things and listening and hearing different things at different times. And it's what you and I have talked about a lot. Certain music resonates at certain times and speaks to you. Like that last story he gave us was beautiful.
Yeah.
Where, you know, people said, you know, you did something to me. There was something in your music that spoke to me, that talked to me, that made me react. I love hearing that story yes. from musicians.
Yeah. I really like those stories and his thought process about the music and what it is. And it is something, the songs become something that are so much bigger than the individual components, even the words. And he was mentioning the guitar, the drums, the bass, they become something so much more than all of that. And it's something different to every listener, right?
One of the things that I took note of is when he was talking about the Lhasa Club.
Yes.
And he said, you know, I wanted the drums to sound, I am fanatical about tone. And so I want the space, the drums to speak within the space, right?
Yep.
In the right way. And I think that's one of the things that as someone, if I'm not a musician, you are, I see it as someone comes on stage and plays the music that I expect them to play. And it's the thought process behind that and that consideration for who's listening. That's a component I've never thought of. And the way he spoke about it. I said, well, of course that's what they do. Doesn't everybody do that?
No.
And it was really eye-opening for me to hear that someone took that much consideration about how I am going to hear it. I found that really fascinating.
Yeah, that really was. Yeah, and I was at that gig, and I thought it was...
You were in the room.
Yeah.
You were in the room, dude, and David Robeck was in the room.
I never realized
how
I was in the same
place.
Room. It's small. It was a small LA club. I don't know what the capacity would be, but I'd be surprised if you could fit a couple hundred people in there.
Okay.
Not even that many. But yeah, it's just a little square room. And yeah, I never even knew that I was in the same room with David Robeck, but I thought that was particularly interesting, the fact that he was playing drums. He was that much into getting the sound for that room, and his former bandmate Perry Farrell was also
pointing a finger at him and laughing.
Yeah, but David Robeck was in the room, heard what Aaron was playing and his sound and his style, and thought it was so good that he asked him to be a part of his project, and that started their relationship because of Aaron's approach.
Yeah.
To the sound and the drums. So.
It's just, I like hearing musicians talk about their craft.
Yes.
And he seems someone to be, you know, very chill about it, but very proud of the work he's done, and he should be.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's good.
And I think I did learn a little bit more about Kendra Smith and David Roback. The thing that my biggest takeaway was when Aaron used the word cerebral.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my biggest takeaway as far as the discussion about David Roback and how cerebral he is or was.
And, you know, Kendra is, to me, Kendra is shrouded in this mystery, very similar to David Roback. And for him to use the term, you know, she's more heart, that was something, that was my takeaway. And I know how accomplished she is as a musician, and then when someone can refer to her as kind of earthy and opening her heart, I'm like, now I want to know more about her. And and, you know, my resources are relatively limited.
Yeah.
Of what's out there, right?
Exactly, yeah.
So we have to kind of reconstruct with eyewitnesses. You know how he said, you know, I'm a nobody. And I'm thinking to myself, you're an eyewitness.
Exactly.
And that has a lot of value.
Yeah. And you could tell he, and just his passion for music, that alone is one of the things that makes him special. So,
yeah.
Yeah. I think he's a special guy.
So. I tip my hat to a guy that took a year listening to Miles Davis and could, every day was a new experience. I mean,
yes.
That's awesome.
Yes, yes. So up next, we've been talking about David Roback. So you had asked me one time what were some things that I came across in my CD collection while I was going through old boxes that I haven't opened up since 2005 or something like that.
Okay.
And I'm still going through stuff. One of the things that I found was a CD by Viva Saturn of the unreleased album Ships of Heaven, which we talked to a little bit about Stephen Roback. But next up, I say we try to give Stephen Roback a call and find out about this unreleased album, maybe walk through some of these tracks. What do you think?
I think it's a great idea, and I'm going to hope that he's happy that you have an unreleased album in your collection.
We'll see. We'll see. I hope so, too.
But I think that's fantastic, and I can't wait to speak with him again. He's been so kind to us and generous with his time, and I love speaking with him. So.
Well, let's see if we can make that happen.
Awesome. So, gente, agruviar.
Groove on, Paisley people.
Thank you. watching town.